Hey everybody, it's Shop Talk Show, episode number 188, brought to you in part by lynda.com. We're going to try this with some beat.
LYNDA.com.
Ouch. That was our worst one yet, but you know what's better than that? The actual website, lynda.com. Yeah, it's really good. It's way better than Bad Online Harmonies. It's an online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. I don't know, though, that they have any singing classes, but they have so many other classes. We're going to tell you about some of them that I went and hand-picked that I thought would be awesome because I would want to listen to them. But the URL, again, is lynda.com/shoptalk, and that's the URL you got to go to get the free 10-day free trial. So please do that. And the SaaS Summit, literally sasssummit.com. It's a two-day virtual conference about leveling up your SaaS and CSS skill set and lots of topics directly about SaaS, and then things that are like tangential to SaaS, like creating your own personal CDN, post CSS, which I think is really interesting and related to SaaS that we'll talk about when we tell you more about these things later on in the show. Go to sasssummit.com for now, and let's kick things off.
Oh, here it is. 5-part harmonies over Skype. I found the course. This is it, Chris. Shop Talk Show.
We could do it. We just need 10 seconds to practice. There's no cadence or anything. We need like we could work it out. We're capable of doing this. Right. Next time. That's why, you know, you got to keep listening to this show. This is a rapid fire episode. It's our 52nd rapid fire episode ever. It's one of those ones where we don't have any guests and we don't dig into like the news of the day or anything, because we have, thanks to you all, have quite a question bank to work through. It's not like overwhelmingly lots of it, but it's pretty full of questions. And I like to go through there and grab ones out and then do shows like this once in a while to kind of reduce that. So if you've written in, you have a higher chance of having us do your question on air. Occasionally, we need to not do them because they are very similar to so many other questions we've had in, and that's not your fault. Yeah. I get it, but they fall into our FAQ category, which there's a URL on Shop Talk Show, shoptalkshow.com/FAQ, I think, that says what those are, and other episodes that you could listen to where we cover that. Is I find that when we do those questions over and over again, and I go back and listen to our show, I'm kind of bored of listening to us talk about it, and if I'm bored, you're bored. So let's do more interesting and unique questions like this one. From Adam Davidson, who writes in, Dave, you take it.
I understand Jekyll is a static site generator and hear loads of things about how great it is. No bloat, no database, it's fast, etc. But what I don't understand is why would you use this over standard HTML files? What can I get with Jekyll that is more superior? Is there just the ability to write in Markdown? Is that the only benefit?
So he's just wondering what Jekyll does and why you would do it. So in the end, yes, you could just write HTML files and put them on a server, and that could be your site. That's the output of Jekyll anyway. But and then in order to get, let's say, well, you'd have to run some kind of Markdown processor. And a Markdown processor just really, it turns Markdown directly into HTML. It doesn't put it into a complete HTML template for you. So you'd need some kind of thing to do that for you if you wanted to write in Markdown. Also, if you wanted to have kind of a blog structure with like special URLs, so it wasn't just like, you know, name of HTML file .html, you'd have to probably make folders right in your project and put like, you know, 2015 and then another folder inside of that that says 08 and then put the thing in there. You know, like URL structures would be kind of on you to create manually. And let's say you then wanted to, change what CSS file your file was using. You'd have to go into every single one of those HTML files and find where the link href thing is and change it to a different CSS file. You know, like manually working in HTML files lends you no abstraction at all. It would just be a lot of work to manually manage HTML files. And that's kind of really what Jekyll is giving you, is you can write in these markdown files. And then when you run a Jekyll build, it does all kinds of stuff. It takes the markdown file and it puts it into a template for you. And then the template is what turns into the HTML file. And all you have to do is change that template to link to a different CSS file. And then it will rebuild your entire site and all the pages will link to that new CSS file. And that's just one example. You know, you get the URL structure. You have this ability to work with drafts. You have the ability to have multiple different kinds of template files. So maybe it's not just a blog, but it's also like portfolio projects or static pages. You have this ability to use some dynamic content like variables and things. You do get a lot through Jekyll, but I'd say the primary benefit is this idea that you write in these simple markdown files as kind of the data source, and it combines them with templates into the final product of your website. That's the core benefit of running something like Jekyll. What do you think, Jay?
Yeah, I mean, it's why would you use PHP or something? You know, you can write HTML, but boy, do you have to write it. My favorite example, I mean, just a loop of posts, like an index of your posts. You can go through and manually write those all, you know, every single HTML, every single hyperlink.
Oh, that's
every single
a very tab. Good point. So now this, not only have you written the post, but you need to go update the index of the homepage of where you link to that. But now you have, every time you write a blog post, you have at least two places to go update now.
Or your RSS feed, three places. Or your Google crawlable sitemap, four places.
So
there's reasons why you want some sort of system to generate your site. And Jekyll is a static site, meaning like you are just given a folder full of HTML files and folders. Or you can do the dynamic site, which is like WordPress or, you know, at Rails or anything really with like a database backend that you hook into. So what I like about it is it has all the content separation of a backend database, but it is perfect for smaller sites, like going to set up a database and then you have like authentication. Now you have to have a little admin to write to the database from the cloud. That's like a lot of action for me. So that's a lot of stuff, a lot of variables, a lot of things that break, caching on WordPress, for example. WordPress would be my like go-to for just a small site, and caching on WordPress is sort of a nightmare. It just falls over and breaks. And then you're like, what's happening? I can't even log into my site. That is stuff I don't like. So Jekyll takes all that stuff away from you, and you just write. You know, I could do templating just like PHP templates. I can do, I can like save big old data structures in a data folder if I want to. There's a lot of stuff in Jekyll that you can do, and that's why I like it.
Moves where the problems could happen. Like if there's going to be a problem, it's going to be locally. It's going to be during the build process, and if that's solved, then it's fine live.
Yeah, like I'm gonna find out about it on my machine real quick. Like it's gonna look bad or whatever. And there's a little bit of safety in just deploying HTML. I mean, security is one thing, but like no dynamic scripts, so no hacks. Like, well, that's minimal hacks, I guess, available vectors, you know, if you're just uploading static HTML. So I think there's a lot of reasons you'd want to look into it, but it's not for everybody. You know, I mean, the markdown is maybe not the most convincing thing, but it is also a benefit too. Like your articles, my post folder and my drafts folder is just, it's a little metadata at the top, but it's just pure content. Like it's a content, a file, And that is cool to me. Not like when you write straight HTML, then it's like your content and your HTML are all muddled up together. Like so if you ever redesigned, good luck on you, because that would be impossible to redesign. So it just, you have so much HTML in your content, it would be really hard to redesign. So that's,
how Markdown forces you to only have clean content. It's kind of one of the side benefits. It's not just this beautiful syntactic sugar kind of thing. It's the fact that it forces you to not crud up your.
Well, and it's an abstraction. It says like, use this. It will generate HTML. You don't need to know HTML. You just write good content in good portions and focus on doing that and having a good structure, and we'll spit out all the HTML doodads. So I think it's good in that regard. So, all right.
Rich Finelli writes in, he has a question for you, Dave. When you were working with Microsoft on Microsoft.com, were you using, instead of Git, were you using Total or Team Foundation Server, TFS? Apparently it's a Microsoft product. Here on the website it says an enterprise grade server for teams to share code, track work, and ship software for any language all in a simple package. It's the perfect complement to your IDE. It looks like kind of a competitor to what Git can do. Rich says, since this is a Microsoft product, I was wondering if they were using it, and I guess we'll stop there.
I did use TFS at Microsoft, and so my name and mistakes are forever in the repos of Microsoft somewhere. I think that, so it's a Git competitor. But at least back then, and I think I know Visual Studio and .NET, the language and everything's changing, but it was very heavily integrated into your Visual Studio editor. So the way you committed code was through TFS in Visual Studio. And it's also like, you know, it's kind of bundled to issues and agile sprints and all that kind of big business stuff is all kind of built into it. I personally prefer Git. I feel like Git is sort of everyone's like source control. I feel like, you know, you can almost teach anyone Git. Team Foundation Server sort of required a piece of software. It's sort of was a little bit more opaque from my point of view. So I don't use it right now. I think, there's a chance I will be using it again in the future with a client. So, I'm not super looking forward to it, but it is something. But it's really like, once you have a GUI around it, there's kind of no difference. I mean, it's sort of a more terse way to commit code, I would say. But yeah, that's
okay. So you've used it. It's a Git competitor. It's largely the same, but you don't like it as much.
Yeah, and I mean, there's different flavors of Git too. I mean, there's like GitHub, and then there's Bitbucket, and then there's Jira. I like them in that order. Like Jira is maybe my least favorite, you know? And so like, that's to say, like, it's maybe not my favorite, but like I have least or favorite Git versions, you know? So that's something to consider too.
Ben Robertson writes in, I've been trying to learn more about performance, and I feel like it always leads me to server configuration stuff like htaccess and /mod_things and nginx comp files. I understand performance, like minimizing requests, gzip, browser caching, etc. But I feel like I'd like to learn more about how servers work, because I feel like I'm missing out on a big part of the performance picture.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this seems ripe for a Brad Frost, just do this sort of complaint, because all the performance posts are like, just htaccess your mod page speed installs 9,000 Nginx servers in front of it, and bingo, bango, web speed. But yeah. servers are a big part of the performance picture, though. It's a very, I think, you know, we always focus on front end performance. Like, you know, I think in the last episode, we just talked for 6 hours about critical CSS. You know, there's a lot of stuff you can do on the front end. But the back end is sort of, that's a crucial thing too. I mean, I know on, day trip, I used a different server. I used instead of Webrick, I used the Puma web server, which is a Ruby thing, and it's multi-threaded, way faster, allows more connections. And I went from maybe 600 milliseconds to like 200 milliseconds for the first page to serve.
200 is a good number. Like 100 is a really good number, you know, but you want to keep that real, real fast. Cause in order for the front end to even start doing anything at all, it needs the document. So this is the classic thing. I think it's an old, like Steve Souder's web performance adage is the 80-20 thing, in that 80%, you know, 20% of the time generally, and this is just a rule of thumb kind of thing, is the time that it takes for the browser to get the document. Once it's got the document, mm-hmm. it can read through it really quick, and then it has to start downloading assets and rendering and doing all this stuff. And the other 80% of the time is for the page to kind of load is doing front-end related stuff. And that's just very high-level. I never know if I'm using high level correctly in a sentence, but that's just because there's, you know, like, what is it until the DOM is done, until the page is fully loaded, until it starts to render, until it looks visually complete. There's lots of like, what 100% are we talking about here? That's, so it's just a very general kind of thing, but 20% is what Dave was talking about, the 600 milliseconds, the 200 milliseconds. That stuff is very important, but it's a smaller chunk than the front end stuff. So Ben, the fact that you're working on a lot of front end stuff, that's, you know, generally considered for performance stuff is where time is best spent. But that is that time good? Because if that time is bad coming back from the server, if it's taking 1.5 seconds for your server to cough up that document, that's server level stuff that's important to figure out. But it's probably a little bit deeper than maybe just your server, HT access stuff. There's probably like database stuff that's being slow if that's the case, or not good enough server level caching things going on if that's the case. So it is so important to figure out. And not only is it's not just 20%, but if your site is going to like fall over, if your site's going to crash or something, which is the worst performance problem you can have, that's a server level thing probably. It's not a front end thing probably. So yeah, I definitely think it's worth, if you're very interested in performance and you already have a grasp on the front end stuff, to be one of those people that focus on performance from both sides could be awesome.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot to kind of learn. It depends on what your server setup. Are you using Apache or Nginx?
Or both.
Those are sort of the... Or both. That's there's a tricky thing. So you need to kind of know what you're using. If you just have Apache, there's like a great htaccess file. My favorite file on the internet is the HTML5 boilerplate htaccess file. And you can actually read through it and kind of see what they're doing on the server. They're gzipping, they're minifying, they're adding browser cache timeouts. So like your assets, if somebody refreshes the page, it's already there.
Yeah, they're adding cores headers. There's a lot going on in there. And it's doing it in a way that like is kind of will work no matter what.
Yeah. Like it is kind of the, it's a tank. It's your tank. Okay. And then Nginx was made by some Russians and it is very crafty and fast and multi-threaded. And like it is very, like it can handle a lot of traffic. Like it can handle 2,000 requests a second and just be like, bing, 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 bing. I don't care. Like while Apache, 2,000 requests a second, it's going to go, I'm tired. That's a lot of work. these are my impressions of...
Sure. So there's kind of three levels, isn't there? There's this, you know, there's the front end stuff, optimizing images and combining requests and stuff. Then there's this middle layer, which is this server configuration level stuff, like Nginx stuff, like Dave's talking about, and mod, you know, setting expires headers and stuff. And then there's a level even below that, which is just how the actual server is running. Do you have a big box doing it? Does it have enough memory that can handle that kind of thing? And how is the database looking? Are things indexed properly? Is that stuff returning properly? Is there any other layers in between? How's the load balancer doing? There's a lot of levels in the performance world, but assuming that document is coming back quickly, it's still a front end game.
And then that's why people also recommend CDNs. It's basically saying, like, get your assets, your HTML, your HTML, but your CSS, your JavaScript, your images, get those off of that server that does all the work. So it's just a spit out HTML machine, get it off of that server, and then have it distributed around the globe, and so that you can, so people get those files faster. There's kind of like a whole other level of this CDN that serves the files that are generated by the server. So the kind of rule of thumb is make it do less, you know, as least as possible, but there's a lot of things you can do. Who would be a good, Ilya Grigoryk would be a good person to follow. Very smart man, talks a lot about networks and protocols and knows a lot about how servers work. And the next thing that's coming is HTTP2 or H2 as people call it. That's going to be massive for performance and kind of a different way to build websites. So that's kind of neat, but that's kind of happening, rolling out now. So there you go.
All right. So one of our sponsors, you may know, on Chop Duck Show, lynda.com. We mentioned that at the top, lynda.com. Has a bunch of courses on here. And we got a question just totally randomly from a feller named Grant Vinson, who writes in, "I am currently a front-end developer looking to strengthen my design skills. I've looked into lynda.com and I'm almost overwhelmed by the number of courses they have. Are there specific courses geared towards web design that you guys would recommend? Or do you know what's a good starting point for an intermediate designer should be? I started out doing design a few years ago in college, but moved into development, so I'm not a total beginner." Anyway, Grant, yes, we've said it before, there are 3,000 courses on lynda.com. So just going there and typing design, looking around for yourself would be kind of a solid thing to do. There's just a ton of them. So I wouldn't say, like, I don't know, that you should absolutely do this one and not this one is for us to say. It's for you to see. And you know, if you have a membership, you can dip in and, you know, watch the intro, see if you like the professor, see if it's up your alley or not.
Hey, I'm going to give you two professor recs. Is that okay? Can I do that? Is that legal? James Williamson.
Ran into James the other day at a conference. Anyway,
James's soup's cool, has a ton of stuff from kind of, he does like designing icons for the web, really kind of basic HTML stuff, but it kind of gets into kind of bigger picture stuff. James has, I mean, I'm scrolling through, no shortage of courses, 39 courses. And then Ray Villalobos would be another guy.
He used to have a whole show together. Yeah. I've met Ray.
Yeah. Too. We've seen Ray a couple times at the old event parts. Yep. And stuff. And Ray's got 37 courses, and Ray maybe is going to take you kind of more into the like mobile apps with Angular and Ionic, kind of bootstrap layouts, and pulling you further into kind of more devy stuff. Probably good intermediate level setup here. There you go. I'm going to recommend those two teachers.
There you go. And wonderful choices, I'd have to say. You can also go in there and make playlists, so you can create and save playlists that you want to watch later that syncs to all your devices too. If you put the lynda.com app on different things, you can kind of follow around with you, which is kind of wonderful. I was just looking through some of the recently put out courses, being like, add. Localization for developers. How many questions of that have we had on Chop Talk Show? A million, right? I have some experience with, not a ton, but yeah, dozens of questions probably of like, how do I handle this as a developer? How do I ready my sites for it? They have a course on that. WatchOS 2 came out last week. They have a course on what, you know, it's not all like straight up educational stuff. Some of it's like, I'm going to walk you through the new features of WatchOS. You can learn about the own device you maybe even own, which I think is kind of cool. Illustrator, Creative Cloud, Power Shortcuts, Amazon Web Services, Data Services, which was interesting. We just switched to RDS over at CodePen. And I think AWS services are really interesting to look at because there's so many of them and they're so... I don't know, they're a little weird, but clearly really powerful, and I'd love to level up my knowledge of them, even though I work with people that are good at it. Up and running with React.js, you know, they're on top of new technology too at lynda.com. Pretty great. So those are some courses that just caught my eye. Whether you want to set new financial goals, find work-life balance, invest in a new hobby, ask your boss for a raise, find a new job, improve on your current job skills, Lynda.com has something for everyone, and that 10-day free trial is at lynda.com/shoptalk. Okay, where are we at, man?
Oh, geez. Here we go. We got Russ by writes in, hello from St. Louis. Hello, St. Louis. It's good to see you again. When designing progressively for the web, what minimum size do you find most comfortable for touch events? I'm working on a geospatial application that uses media controls, play, step forward, etc. And I am trying to design it in a way that does not detract from the map. Big old buttons would not be ideal. So if you have big buttons, you kind of like... maybe obscures the map. I have some ideas, but I'd like to know if you have any experience in designing for fingers, especially hardy meat hooks like mine. So Russ has those fingers that look like... Sorry.
Same.
Russ has those fingers where like five hot dogs got married. And
yeah, so I don't know if it's up to us to say, but I'd say... the bigger you can make something, the better. If you just have room and you have room to make a really big target, if you have a button that just is sitting in a C and there's plenty of space around it, why not make it bigger? The easier to tap, the better. But you said that you're in a pretty interesting situation where that's not really the case. You have a map and you want to not detract from that map. So, you know, having a giant button that obscures the map isn't ideal. So you want to make it big enough to be very easy and comfortable to tap, definitely not too small, and then obviously not too small to make so that you can't click it at all, or these hot dog fingers of yours are going to be hard to deal with. So a lot of different companies weigh in on this. They say, mm-hmm. on our platform, we want these size to be the thing. The Windows Phone UI guideline says 34 by 34 pixels is ideal, with a minimum of 26 by 26. Nokia says 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter, which apparently on most of their phones is 28 by 28 pixels. iPhone is the biggest. They say 44 by 44. They'd like it to be in pixels. And that's kind of confusing to me because it's kind of like, isn't pixels that they like are different depending on retina or not and all that stuff? So I think physical dimensions is kind of a more interesting.
Yeah. But that also is very, you know, physical on the iPad in the iPad mini, you know, like, do you need to write two different things? But anyway,
probably.
Yeah. So Apple says 44, and I've actually read Medium articles, again, the source of truth for our internet, that are saying that is even too small. Like, you'd actually need bigger for fingers, especially big old meat hooks. The trick though is, here's the trick. You ready? You don't necessarily like the visual area that's tappable doesn't necessarily mean like,
right. It could be be the letter A, but there's like fake invisible padding all around that.
Yeah.
A. So it's not visually obscuring anything.
Yeah. You have add the invisible padding around it so that the tap area is bigger. Where it gets trouble is if you have a nice tight UI, like where two buttons are next to each other, now your padding might overlap and you might miss key something. So that's something to consider too. But maybe you can err on the left or the right of the button and assume people know how to click or tap.
There you go. Buttons or in development, each other. Set a transparent-ish background red to it or something, so you can see what those areas are that won't be there in production, but you see them in development.
And then probably the best thing you could do is take a version of your app and go to Starbucks and just have people tap around it and just see what they're having problems with, that like do some straight up guerrilla user testing.
And size isn't the absolutely only thing that you have to worry about. Of course, there's a, like, can you, if you have four buttons that you need to expose on your map, Russ, can you hide some of them? You know, that's why hamburgers are so popular, because they hide a bunch of UI in something that kind of only comes out when it's necessary. So if you have four buttons that you're trying to fit on your map, could there be one button that temporarily exposes those four other buttons and is closable, so then what you're obscuring on the screen in the default state is less? You know, size isn't the only design consideration, of course.
So, I think you have a few options there. Hopefully that helps. I find it different that every kind of organization has a different version of what's acceptable. That's very interesting to me.
It is very weird.
There's also this idea, you know, I don't Android, the material design, you know, the things that are important are bigger, you know, that action button is the biggest button. So maybe there's a thing where hierarchy of importance, you know, like if somebody needs a really granular control, you know, maybe you can make it a little smaller. I don't know. But, good luck. Hopefully that helped. But when you're overlaying it over something interactive, like a map, which I think is what you kind of were describing, that's even more tough, because then you're like an interaction machine over an interaction machine. So, all right. Next question comes from Chris House. Chris writes in, what does the term cascade mean in regards to CSS? There seems to be two commonly used but different definitions. The first is that the cascading is the method in which conflicts are resolved when multiple styling rules apply to the same element. For instance, the way selector with a higher specificity overrides a selector with a lower specificity, or the way styles declared inline over those declared in an external style sheet. This is the cascade at work. The second definition I also see you, Chris, use a lot. Cascading is when an element will inherit certain properties that are declared on one or more of its containing elements. For example, the font size declared on the body will cascade down and affect all the font size of all the P elements. So which is it? Or is it both? Or does it even matter? Thank you, guys.
Well, how much it matters is kind of up to you, I guess. It seems, kind of looking around a little bit, that it's kind of more like the first definition. There's some clearly bad written stuff about this. But one of them's like, well, the fact that you can put two style sheets on one document means cascading. I was like, that's a little weird. The one is like, let's say some place in the style sheet you wrote H3 color red. But that H3 tag in HTML has like class equals P1 on it for like priority one. And then somewhere else in that style sheet, P1 has color blue on it. And then it turns out in the document it's blue because the class has a higher specificity than the H3 does. So it wins. So that's cascade at work, is that there's different specificity and different pieces of that CSS affecting the same thing, and it deals with it. That doesn't like link up in my mind. I think of that as specificity, which is just a different concept. So it sounds like you've accused me of being someone that uses the word cascade to mean that, for example, you could have P1 color red, but then you have a span within that H3 tag that there's a span in there and it has another word. That span is going to be blue as well, because P1 had color blue on it, and that blue is going to cascade down to that span, and it's just going to be blue too, unless some other thing overrides it. That's how I think of cascading, but I'm not sure how technically accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe it's inheritance is the better word, but yeah.
Yeah, well, that
all CSS falls downhills. I guess CSS styles fall downhill. In the same way that the specificity, you know, collides and stuff like that, I think, yeah, the like style also cascades down through, I don't know, inheritance is probably the correct word, because it just inherits.
I think it's specificity one is the kind of more technically correct one, but well, I'm not sure it matters that much. But yeah, the downhill, CSS falls downhill. I like that. Let's go with that. Sorry, we don't have a more, you know, I'm sure there's like CSS, like super nerds out there that could give us a whole lesson in what that means.
We maybe even be wrong on, there's an article on SitePoint, the cascade, specificity, and inheritance. So it tries to apply definitions to all three of these. Oh, wait, is it? It's a very short article, and I should be able to read it, but I'm not going to. I'll let you read it. Good luck. I'll put it in the show notes. I don't know if it's going to solve the problem, but anyway, here we go.
Matt. Litzinger. I have been learning a lot about keyboard accessibility lately, and I'm trying to be more proactive in using this best practice. Any advice on controlling focus, specifically within drop-down menus or otherwise hidden elements?
Oh boy, you have entered Dante's fifth circle of hell. And man, keyboard focus is tough, because only a few sites probably do it really well. You know, there's when you enter a menu or something, you should be able to enter the menu and use your keys left, right, up, down to kind of like drive and open and expand and drive left, right all
hopefully
the way through
kind
the
of
menu.
Announces that you can go left or right somehow. I would think, you know, there's the word drop down menu sometimes means like a native select. And I think that's always kind of nice, you know, maybe not for navigation, but if that's the kind of UI that you're referring to, Matt, just using the native browser version of input elements tends to be good for accessibility, right? Because you get a bunch of accessibility like functionality for free, as they say.
Yeah. Like if you use the like native select, I'm thinking more navigational menu. Yeah. Like a mega menu or something.
So let's say you have you've styled it as nested lists. So there's unordered list, and they're all within each other. And then you have, you know, you've styled it so that any nested unordered list is like display none, because they need to be hidden. Because what you want it to do is when you click on it or when you hover it or whatever interaction you choose, it then reveals that sub list. So then it's on you. Mm-hmm. You could do that in CSS, I guess. I mean, it's harder to do in CSS unless you go all hover. Because CSS doesn't really have a great system for have I clicked this thing or not. There's kind of focus and active states and stuff, but they're just not the greatest thing to rely on, I don't think. So you've already made the choice to use display none. What did that do? Should I have kicked it off the page with position absolute, or should I have used clipping on it instead because that's more accessible hiding tactic? Or should those menu items have been hidden because they're annoying in the DOM anyway, and there's a way to expand it with keyboard, you know, some kind of keyboard shortcut thing anyway? I agree, Matt. It's hard to wrap your head around, like, even just this simple-ish thing of how do I make my menu accessible is kind of mind-blowing. I tend to look around for example, pens on CodePen of keyboard accessible drop-down menu, and then kind of copy what they did.
If you go to a11yproject.com/patterns, we've been kind of building out a pattern library of accessible patterns. Dennis Gable has a really basic drop-down where you tab in and you go up and down and like just drive a keyboard like you would kind of like you visually drive a keyboard, but you have to kind of remember like you don't have vision sometimes. Some people don't have vision. So you kind of have to, you just try to keep it spatial, kind of like you're going left and right and up and down. And then there's also a bunch of ARIA stuff you have to trigger, like ARIA visible, ARIA has pop-up, ARIA, like it's a lot of action. I won't lie to you. And that's maybe one of my beefs with accessibility. It's the most verbose way to do something. So, anyway, but there's ways to do it. And I'm sure there's JS plugins, if you want it. But the thing, if you're trying to browse the web there, like that's the other thing too, is like, sorry, if you're just trying to browse the web, not everyone does it really great. So it's kind of hard to do. It's kind of hard to get around, but kudos to you for kind of empathizing with people who only use keyboard.
I think there's some best practices, like don't try to get real clever with tab index or something. Be like, oh, I know where tabbing should go next. I'm going to enforce that. Like the chances of you screwing that up are really high. So just don't do that, because tab order is kind of maintained by document order in a better way than you could probably do.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, yeah, you don't want to fuss with tab index unless you absolutely know what you're doing. It's tough. I mean, I think really like learning the screen reader, hitting Command F5 and going on Mac, that is, but like Windows has Narrator. I forget how to turn it on, but I've turned it on by accident before. Just learning a screen reader so you kind of understand what happens, then understanding all screen readers are different. So there's a lot of variables there. So good luck. And yeah, I think the gold standard for any website, here's Dave Rupert having opinions. I think the gold standard is having a website that is keyboard navigable. I think if your website can't do that at a minimum, you've messed up. So I think we should all kind of work on making it to where somebody can kind of tab through your website to make sure it works, or tab through critical forms would be another good thing too. So anyway, good luck with that. It takes seconds to do. You should really be doing it. Anyway, okay, go ahead,
Chris. You know where there might be a little talk about accessibility kind of sprinkled throughout it, and I very much assume this is the case, is probably the upcoming SaaS Summit. That's sasssummit.com. It'll get you where you need to go. It's coming up this November 18th and 19th. It's all day in the middle of the day, but it's online, right? So it's one of these conferences that you can attend from the comfort of wherever you're sitting in front of an internet connected device, and you can kind of participate in it. The speakers are speaking live and there's a live chat room, and you kind of just hang out with everybody else who's coming to this conference. It's a pretty fun little situation. So this one's all about SaaS. So the topics include SaaS, but also, as we mentioned at the top of the show, creating your own personal CDN. That's pretty interesting. Post CSS is a hot topic, and I mentioned that's particularly hot because I think what's getting to be more and more popular is a build process in which that you use SAS and then you sprinkle in some post CSS at the end, and you're probably maybe already doing this because if you've heard of auto prefixer and how immensely popular that is as a project, that's just a plugin for post CSS. So a very common workflow is to run SAS and then run auto prefixer over it. And because auto prefixer is just a plugin for post CSS, there's other little plugins for post CSS. One of them I know is popular is one that combines all of the media queries. So, you know, SAS, when you nest a media query, it doesn't combine them all together. We'll do that. It'll go grab all of the similar media queries throughout your style sheet and combine them all together, because that's just it's kind of an efficiency that SAS doesn't give you that post CSS can do. There's lots and lots and lots and lots of cool plugins for post CSS. And so kind of the thinking is, why not use SAS? Because we all like SAS, and SAS is pretty good, and SAS has made a lot of really smart choices over the years. And there's lots of tutorials for it and community for it. And it does a good job, all trust in SAS. And then kind of sprinkle in little things that are unique to post CSS that do kind of cool things that SAS kind of can't do or won't do or for the kind of the sanctity of the language won't do. So I think that's pretty interesting. I don't know how in depth there's talks on post CSS, and I very much assume that stuff like that will be part of the conversation at SAS Summit. There's talks about web typography, animation, lots more stuff. The very first talk, using musical scales to build harmonious typographic scale. How cool is that? You know, just interesting things like that. Looping and animation, making your own games. linting for fun and profit by Snugog, Sam Richard, who Dave just talked about, being that there's now linting available.
No SAS linter.
Yeah, yep. That's a thing you can do now. Pretty darn cool. It's all coming up November 18th and 19th. Register yourself at sassummit.com, and as you're doing so, make sure to use coupon code 20% off for the registration for that. Lots of Q&A, lots of fun stuff going on at that. Very much recommend it. Let's see, who do we have a couple more to do in this rapid fire episode. John,
yeah, here we go.
Writes in, is there a great place to go for learning how to master WordPress's functions.php file? Feel like my template development would be a lot stronger and easier if I only understood what could go in that file.
Yeah, there isn't I'm googling live googling here on the Shop Talk Show.
There's something you're trying to figure out.
Functions.php generator. I know that sounds like, well, I wouldn't use a generator. I'm a civilized human being, but it's wpfunction.me. I think this is the one. So it's like you check, use check boxes to like say, like, I want to use this one and this one and this one. And you can make things really cool, like add a custom login page, add a post page thumbnails to each theme. You know, you're going to want them thumbnails on the posts. You add posts and comments. You theme the admin area, custom menus. Oh, there's so many.
So those are, this is interesting though, because already it's kind of like you're making choices of things. So what functions.php file is a kind of a catch-all place where PHP is going to execute when your page loads. And so WordPress has this concept of hooks in it, meaning like there's a hook for enqueuing
before scripts. Yeah, enqueue scripts. So before page load.
Yeah, right. There's just an epic amount of WordPress is like built on these things practically. So there's a hook that gets called, and you can say when that hook runs, I want to override it, for example, and I want to do my own thing there. Or I want it to do what it's already going to do, but also do these other things. So one of them I have is the and CSS tricks. I'm just looking through mine is, and I have a bunch of stuff in here. One of them is to deregister the version of jQuery that's already going to load on WordPress if you ask for it, or if any plugin asks for it, and say this is the URL that I want you to load jQuery from. So I can load it from a CDN or whatever, and I can load a more recent version of jQuery than what WordPress ships with or whatever. That's just how I'm choosing to do it. So that's just a thing that's in my functions.php file because I'm able to do it, and it's fairly specific to the theme, my theme. So that's what's important about functions.php is if I switch themes, do I need this anymore? Maybe not really. Maybe this other theme doesn't really need jQuery, so I'm not going to specifically load it because, like, I don't know, maybe this theme doesn't need it. Or this theme supports WooCommerce, so I'm going to declare support for it in this theme, but maybe some other theme doesn't. So it makes sense to be in functions.php because functions.php is theme dependent. There's a different functions.php file and a different theme. So it won't run on another theme. If you're doing PHP things like this, hooking into these hooks and doing all that other stuff, that it affects your entire site regardless of what theme is active, that's not a good place for functions.php. That's PHP. That's time to make a little plugin of your own. And it's very easy to make a plugin. It's basically the same format as a functions.php file. It just has a little metadata at the top, and then you dump it in the plugins folder instead of your themes folder and just activate it. For example, declaring a custom post type. Let's say on this WordPress site, you're like, I have a concept on this site of meetings, and I'm going to use WordPress to schedule meetings or something. And each meeting has a date and a time, and it has a room that it's going to be in, and it has a bunch of specific metadata. That's core to the site that I'm building. It doesn't matter what theme is active. Those meetings need to be available regardless of what theme is active. And if you put that code in your functions.php file and then you switched themes and it no longer declares those custom post types, that's a problem. They're just going to instantly disappear. Yeah. Well, they're not really. They're still in the database. So when you switch the theme back, everything will be okay. But that can be like a heart-wrenching moment. So functions.php files for PHP e code that need to run, need to hook into stuff that's very specific to the theme. And it's not like the sky's the limit here. You can do whatever you want in there. And there are common things, you know, but for the most part, it's weird stuff. For example, in my CSS Tricks 1, I do have a custom login page that I style up differently. So when that page loads, I add a special CSS file that overrides that. I like to use SVG for a lot of stuff in WordPress, and that's not natively enabled by WordPress for some obscure security reasons, but I'm okay with that because it's only me and my site, and I'll do whatever I want. I enable some SVG support in mine. I'm using in the new design that I'm about to launch for CSS Tricks, I have a thing where it's going to display recent jobs from the CodePen job board, which, by the way, is the same thing as the ShopTalk job board. So the way that it does that is it does a curl request, essentially, for some JSON out on the CodePen site, and then processes it and does some stuff with it, and then saves that in a transient, which is a WordPress kind of thing, for a caching mechanism, which is pretty cool. That's really specific to this theme on CSS Tricks. So it's in my functions.php file, because it may not matter for a different theme that doesn't display jobs like that. I customized my comments, and at one point I had probably 50 things that were happening in here. And I took a look at one point, and anything that was important to CSS Tricks that didn't matter about the theme, I moved into a plugin-like structure. And anything that was specific to the theme at hand, I left in functions.php. So I kind of just somewhat recently went through this thing. So hopefully that's useful to you.
There you go. You can do kind of anything you want. Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice little custom dumping ground.
It's a dumping ground, for better or worse.
All right. We got a couple more here. Rich Finelli, two questions, one show. Rich, you may have earned yourself a coffee mug. Here we go. Do we still need to create a sitemap for a site? I don't think anyone typically uses them except for circumstances where they can't find what they're looking for. Does Google need it?
So I think he's not saying like a sitemap.xml, but a link in the footer.
Yeah, like a view our sitemap. I have not done one in a long time, but that doesn't mean you should not do one.
It does seem a little weird and off-trend, kind of. But I don't know, maybe if it was like a university site or some kind of thing where there was a deeply nested structure and you could make a fairly decent-looking little UI that just listed every single page on the site for, I don't know, I'm not against that concept necessarily.
No, I it could be helpful. I mean, if your users are requesting it, but I
wouldn't lean on it. You know, like your navigation your site should have good enough UI/UX for people to get where they need to get without consulting a sitemap, you know?
I think most people just search and they're not there to browse your site, sadly. No one wants to browse your site, and no one wants to browse a list of words. They want to do that even less. But Google likes your XML. They like to crawl the XML.
I would say they wouldn't mind your regular sitemap either, though, you know. That's how they normally crawl the site, and then it's kind of proof that people can get to those pages, whereas I feel like an XML sitemap represents all their pages, but there's no necessarily any proof that anybody else could get there too, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there could be a hidden page in your sitemap, and then why would Google rank that highly? So your secret page.
There are some businesses that kind of do that growth hacking-y stuff where it's like best web design agency, Austin, Texas web design, Austin, Central Texas. You know, that's bad. Don't do that. But I mean, if you want to get ranked for some weird thing, maybe it really helps. I don't play the, let's trick Google guys game. I would not recommend you do that either, but maybe it works for you. Maybe you're happy doing that yourself. Okay. So hopefully that answers Mr. Rich's question. Thanks for sending in so many questions, Rich. We kind of depend on that content here. So I have one final question, audio question from James Finn. Here we go.
Hey guys, I've landed the role of project manager in a three-man startup, and I was hoping you both could give me some insights into what methods have worked for you when it comes to budget estimates, particularly as it pertains to time.
Double it.
Perhaps there are other resources or tools you found helpful that you could recommend. I'm particularly interested if there are existing guidelines that could be referenced as industry standards. Thank you.
All right. So James seems he's starting a small company, three-person shop.
I'm very interested in the smallness and the fact that you're a PM at it. Like we're very similar situations. I have two co-founders at CodePen. Dave has two co-founders at Paravel. We're three-man play, but all of us do a lot of, like, I can't imagine what it would be like at CodePen if one of us was just a PM and didn't, you know, and I don't know that's the case for you, James, but I'm imagining maybe there's just, you're just kind of there to keep everybody on track and that type of thing. I think that would be very weird at such a small thing of CodePen if I was just like, how you doing over there, Tim? You doing some coding? Cool. Why don't you do some different type of coding later? You know, and be like, leave me alone.
But maybe there's some business and maybe James does some design development as well, in addition to all the,
sure,
the business tasks.
I think that's very likely.
So in our company, Trent Walton does all this stuff. But we all kind of do budgets and estimates together. I think that's kind of an important part. We just kind of went through this recently. We're like, one person, Trent, will just take a stab at it and just say, like, what is this? Does this look right? And shop it around to Reagan and I, and we'll either say, yeah, that sounds like the right amount of development, or that sounds like too much, or that sounds, you know, design doesn't need to be that long. This is very straightforward, stuff like that. So we kind of can hammer out proposals together.
That idea that, like, just pick some numbers and then talk about it with the team. That seems like you've proven then that you've put some effort in here and it can frame the conversation rather than just hopping into Slack and being like, we got to get a budget together. What do you think? You know?
Yeah. So there's kind of two schools of thought as you get into this is the, do I charge hourly or do I charge,
by the project
value
or by the
based?
Week
or... Yeah. And you know, Dan Moll is very much in the value-based pricing. Like, what's it worth to your company for me to come in and do this? You know, because Walmart and some like bespoke shoe store in I don't know, Paris, Texas, will have different needs. You know, so and he can make websites for both of them, but you know what, the budget is going to be different. So he kind of wants to know what it's worth for you, and maybe we can make this work based on the value that the clients have. And then the other one is kind of hourly pricing. You decide on a number that your company is worth per hour. And usually it's, you get to that by doubling it until people start saying no. And that can be tough, but you just have to kind of learn, or just come up with what's fair. Like, what do you all need to live? You know, and if you miraculously booked out every hour of your month, you know, does your hourly meet that need? And then do you charge per person per hour? And so each person kind of tallies up their hours. I know Sparkbox does a pretty good job at that. Or do you kind of just give away the whole agency? We kind of give away the whole agency at an hourly. So that's sort of it. It's you kind of have to decide on what the number is for your company. And then you can sell chunks of time, or you can just say, like, this project will take 10 chunks. And so it's 10 times this hourly, or maybe you bill in weeks. Maybe you only want to join for 2 week sprints. Maybe you only want to join for months at a time. You kind of have to decide, but, that's all sales tricks sort of from here on out, and how you feel comfortable selling yourself. And what you think that there's, like, the reading the client, like, what do you think they're going to respond with? You know, that I think that's important, you know, is how do you do this going forward? So you have to kind of decide what you're comfortable with and choose that. Businessology and Bizcraft are good shows for that. I really like Mean Gene Crawford and Carl the Jellyfish King Smith. So check those podcasts out as well. So industry standards was another part of that question. AIGA, the like Graphic Design Institute, I think they have a lot of stuff on like contracts and billing and how to structure a thing. And so an estimate. And so you may want to check that out. But I think, am I talking too long? I'm just saying when it comes down to it, it's sort of all guesswork because you don't know when you open up a site, is it going to be a rat king or is it going to be like, this is the best code I've ever seen.
It's going to come with experience, you know, is it? I'm sure everybody has like good stories and bad stories of how that's.
Well, there's also like other, like there's tricks. I mean, and I don't know if it's ethical or not, but it's like, I'm always like, I'm going to assume the worst thing and give you kind of a number in that ballpark for the worst thing I've ever seen. But then some companies will just kind of lowball it. And then they like, they just to get in on the job and then scope creep comes and they charge more and more and more and more for it. Like they're really good at charging for scope creep. So that's something too. You know, I don't know. We tend to pitch in spans, like it's anywhere from here to here based on how easy it goes. And we're pretty honest with our hours, like very honest. So, that's sort of how we bill things, like a span of hours, but, oh, that's it. That's all I got.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, I think I'm tired of talking. So this is going to conclude this episode of the Shop Talk Show. Thank you for following us on Twitter, subscribing to us in your podcatcher of choice. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a new job. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I, at this point, have had another child, I hope. And so this is very exciting. I am not sleeping, but I hope you've been enjoying these rapid fires. We'll be back with some more shows coming up. And I'm blanking on, oh, we got some more fun theme shows, right? Coming up, Chris, it'll be fun and some guests. So we're going to go on some deep dive with some guests. So
it should be exactly good times. Right. Ahead. It really will be a fun time. Stay tuned to Shop Talk Show. And I think I've got the shoptalkshow.com.